Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with me, David Taylor, and him, Phil Bishop. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of March 2022, and despite everything kicking off in the most disagreeable way in Eastern Europe, we're here to discuss more palatable topics relevant to the UK construction industry. So I hope you've got some good stuff to talk about today, Phil.
Palatable. I see what you did there, but we'll get
palatable,
on
palatable, yeah.
We'll get on.
Yeah, it's very subtle.
We'll get on to that later. Yeah, morning, David. Thoughts with Ukraine, but let's be parochial and talk about the UK construction industry, as is our wont.
Yep.
First topic I would like to talk about, if we may, is there's a rather interesting and important job vacancy up for grabs. Mm-hmm. And I thought you might like to apply for it, David. I think you are just the person they could be looking for. I'm talking, of course, about the Construction Leadership Council needs a new co-chair, industry side chair. Andy Mitchell, the Tideway chief executive, is done a goodly stint and a good job as well by any reckoning. And he's stepping down. They're looking for a replacement. What do you reckon? Are you up for it?
Well, I'm certainly not up for it because it would mean I'd have to travel outside Devon. No, that's not the real reason, of course. For the very good reason that I am completely unqualified for the role. I mean, it's a job, obviously a very, very important job, as you say, very, very influential post. And it does require, I think, I wouldn't say a unique combination of skills and talents, but certainly a broad range. And you've got to be good at quite a lot of things. Andy Mitchell is the chap who's stepping down, and as you say, he's been there for a long time and has done a good job by all accounts. But it's a political role as much as anything else, isn't it? Because you can't be too partisan. You could say that you could have the chief executive of a major tier one contractor representing the industry side, but you know, they're representing the tier one contractors. So it needs to be somebody with a more neutral position. And I mean, Andy Mitchell, who's the boss of Tideway, of course, is in a good position. He's the boss of a major infrastructure project, but he hasn't got an axe to grind from an industry point of view. So I suppose that's what makes him a good candidate. In fact, I struggle to think of a suitable replacement, actually. Have you got any ideas?
Well, I've been playing amateur headhunter on this one, and Andy Mitchell's come from a client organisation, as did his predecessor. Andrew Wolstenholme was the first industry side chair of the CLC, and at the time when he got that job, he was chief executive of Crossrail. So you think Crossrail, Tideway, of course, the Thames super sewer that's being built, another big project. So, okay, you're looking for someone who heads up a major project. Who does that sound like? Well, Mark Thurston, HS2. But, I mean, I don't even know how Andy Mitchell found time to do the job, but there's a lot of time involved for nothing, for volunteering your time. Whether Mark Thurston has got the bandwidth to take it on, it would seem... I would worry, frankly. Yeah, HS2's got enough sort of, flak fired its way the whole time. And then I thought, because I think client bodies have often provided the figure. I'm thinking about, back in the day, Peter Rogers of Stanhope sort of used to chair these similar sort of bodies, didn't he, and been involved in things.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I suppose the only other big client organisation I could think of, Heathrow, John Holland Kay, the Heathrow chief executive. He might be the sort of name that might drag out. Maybe a property developer in the sort of Peter Rogers mould would be Rob Knowles, the former Land Securities chief exec. He's now chairman of Hammerson. But, he's an accountant. He's not really a construction man. Peter Rogers was a construction man. So, I don't know. And then you think of sort of the Eminon Grise, if that's the correct pronunciation. You sort of John Armitz or Doug Okeviz. But I don't know whether they've... I mean, they certainly have been energetic, but I don't know whether... I think you need someone perhaps more current and of the moment to get in there.
What's Armit doing at the moment?
Oh, he must be chairing all sorts of things. I'm not sure. I honestly don't know. But I think the moment for Armit to chair something like this may have passed. I'm sorry, John. And other sort of similar sort of grand figures that get wheeled out to lead things, like Judith Hackett and Mark Farmer, it might be bandied around. But I'm not sure about that. What I came back to in the end, it needs to be someone who is palpably a construction person with proper construction experience, I think, who is sufficiently unaligned to a narrow vested interest. Now, the two names I thought of do both come from main contractors, but I think they're possibly sufficiently away from them now. And the names I came up with, Paul Sheffield and Andrew... Now, I never know how to pronounce that. Is it Andrew Wiley, I think, of Costain?
Yes.
These guys have been, you know, chief executives of big tier ones, and they've both been president of the Institution of Civil Engineers in recent years, so they're familiar with the sort of the political side of things and the committees and all of that. And beyond that, I couldn't think of anyone.
Well, you've thrown out several names already. I mean, I couldn't think of one, but I've counted at least seven possibles on your list. And I suppose any of them would be potential candidates. I mean, Mark Farmer, because he's, of course, his famous report, which he produced a few years ago, was another one of these sort of landmark... Modernise or die. He's got the sort of gravitas and the sort of... He's got the vision thing, hasn't he? You know, a bit. You mentioned Peter Rogers earlier. I mean, he was very active, I think, back in the... in the 90s, with the same... doing the same sort of thing. Do you remember with... what's that big development in East London?
Broadgate.
Yeah. Broadgate. That was a landmark project. And he sort of, he in a way sort of was the sort of midwife to the, all these other sort of developing ideas about how we should change construction. And then we had Latham and Egan coming after that. Mark Farmer's in a similar sort of mold, I suppose. He's a sort of a visionary. He's got this idea about how we could improve the construction industry. Maybe he's a sort of person that we ought to have, although maybe he doesn't have the track record of some of the others you mentioned, like Wiley or Sheffield.
From a business sense, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But do you need it? I don't know. I don't know whether Andrew Mitchell is more from the farmer side of things or the Sheffield side of things.
Well, as I said, I think, you know, there's a lot of politics involved. So I think it needs to be somebody who, as you say, is a sound businessman, somebody who can negotiate, somebody who can weigh up the pros and cons quickly and effectively. And that probably needs somebody with a sound business background, I would have thought.
Well, I've got the job spec in front of me, and it doesn't say that you have to have, you know, business skills particularly. It says okay, this sentence I'm going to pick out speaks right to Mark Farmer, doesn't it? They must be a champion for industry change, and also promote inclusion, diversity, and improving the image, sustainability, innovation, all that good stuff. But the champion for industry change is a big thing. The co-chair must already have stature and respect within the wider construction industry. They will leverage their status and reputation to convene the construction sector and will be an advocate on behalf of industry. So that is, you know, you're really you're going to be the lead singer. You're going to be the front man. You're going to be the Mick Jagger of the construction industry.
Yeah, well, I think Farmer's definitely in the frame for that. Especially if the emphasis is on change. He's all about change, isn't he, after all?
Yep, it seems to be. Okay, have we given the job to him then?
Well, yeah, I think we have, actually. Don't ask me to place a bet, but I think that he's probably in with a strong chance if he wants the job.
But thing is, he's, my understanding, I mean, he has his own consultancy business now, but he's a quasi, you know, independent is good, but Andy Mitchell had a nice fat salary, has a nice fat salary from Tideway paying his, you know, paying his, his, for his day job. And is giving away other time for CLC. Yeah. Now, if you run,
are you saying that Farmer probably hasn't got the same sort of financial cushioning?
I have no idea. Maybe you won the pools last week. I have no idea about what his financial circumstances are. But I think if you are employed by another big organisation which is paying your salary, come what may, I want to say, I don't mean exactly like that, but it's there in the background.
I know what you mean.
It might make it easier for you to donate some of your other time.
Although these people of this calibre notoriously have absolutely no time at all. I mean, you can never get to speak to them for a start. They're always too busy. I remember I interviewed a Tier 1 CEO once. This was many, many years ago, and I can't even remember which company it was. When he outlined his daily routine, I mean, I was aghast because he started at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and he didn't finish until after 10. In the evening, that is, not in the morning. And whether or not he was just talking it up or if that really was a typical life of a construction CEO, I've no idea. But I did come away with the feeling, very strong feeling, that I don't care how much they pay me, I wouldn't be doing that job because there was absolutely no work-life balance, although the phrase work-life balance didn't exist back then. But I suppose they say if you want something done, ask a busy person.
I was going to say that, yeah, yeah.
So maybe the busier the better, but you've got to have some time to spare, haven't you, in order to do a job like this some justice.
Yes, and there are an awful lot of meetings involved, and while it's all been Zooming for the past couple of years, I think there'll be, you know, requirement for more face-to-face and speaking at conferences and this, that and the other. There will be more travel involved, I suspect, as well, than there has been lately.
Certainly, I should think so. So, all right then. So, are we going with Farmer on this one?
I still think you could consider applying, David.
Yeah, I just haven't got the time in my busy schedule, Phil. I'm sorry. Or rather, I should rephrase that. I'm just simply not busy enough.
Yes.
All right, then. So, we'll have to see who gets the job. My money's on Farmer, although, to be perfectly honest, having entered this discussion a few minutes ago without any idea who was in the running, I'm really just grasping at straws.
I should say, I should say, this is not, unlike many of these things, they're not sort of smoke-filled rooms picking a buddy out of a hat. Well, it may end up being that, but ostensibly it's being an open application. You can email your applications by the 31st of March, so you've got a good 4 weeks to sort out your story. Yeah. Put your application in. construction.enquiries@beis.gov.uk. That and that email address and the full job description you can find on our the constructionindex.co.uk website, our report of Andy Mitchell's standing down from the CLC. So
I think they'll be inundated.
Apply, people. Apply.
Well, as I said, Phil, at the beginning, and it was a reference which didn't go unnoticed by you, but it wouldn't have meant anything to our listeners, onto a more palatable subject, because it's pallets. There's an organisation which has recently started up called Pallet Loop, which is rather... Do you remember, Phil, when you were a small boy, the milkman used to come round and leave glass bottles full of milk on the doorstep. And when you'd consumed the milk, you rinsed out the bottles and put them back on the doorstep again. And the milkman came along and collected them. And it went around like that.
Well, clearly, I am still a small boy because that still happens.
Really?
I have milk delivered in glass bottles every day.
Well,
not every day, but three times a week.
Well, there we are. Well, it's not just milk that uses that business model. This organisation, Pallet Loop, does the same thing with pallets. So every building site is usually littered with bits of broken pallet and sometimes with whole undamaged pallets. But they are regarded as expendable. I mean, these are just rough wooden constructions.
Single-use objects, aren't they, normally?
Single-use objects, yeah. And, of course, they're made out of a natural material, being wood, and we all know that we should be more responsible when it comes to the environment and not just throw away things when we've finished using them, but try and reuse them, and that's exactly what this is about. So you hire a pallet, or rather you get custody of the pallet. I think that's probably the best way of saying it. Your products, your materials, bricks, for example, are delivered on the pallet. And instead of throwing it on a heap in the corner of the site or in a skip, you keep it, you look after it, and it's collected and it's used by somebody else, and you get your deposit back, just like you did with your milk bottles. But it seems to be catching on, doesn't it, in quite a big way now?
Well, yes, this was we first reported the setting up of it last November. It was an organisation called Scott, well, it's actually two brothers, Paul and Ryan Lewis, who used to own a company called HLC Wood Products. They sold that business in 2015 to Scott Group, which is a leading pallet producer. And the Lewis brothers, together with Scott Group, have said, this is stupid throwing these pallets away. It may be good for pallet makers having to make them all the time, but it's bad for the planet and all of that. Mm. So, and it's quite simple. Their pallets, which are part of this scheme, are painted a almost fluorescent green, a bright green, sort of Hibernian green, with the word loop written across them. And so the same as any other, it's a bit like red diesel, same as any other diesel, same as any other pallet. It's just a different colour, so you know, don't chuck these away. Someone will be along soon to pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And we reported then that BAM, Morgan Sindall and Wilmot Dixon were among major companies, and also Builders Merchants, Bradford's, MKM, various others, early signatories who were all taking part in this scheme. And the reason why we're talking about it now is just last week, a whole bunch more people, John Sisk, mm. Countryside, Marshalls, the paving block people, Wolseley Group, the other another builders materials people, more people are signing up, and it's gaining momentum. And obviously they want more and more people to sign up, and I think they should too. It sounds like I can't see a downside to this. It sounds like a no-brainer.
I wonder how many times you can use your average wooden pallet, because, as I said earlier, I mean, I've never really thought about anybody making them. They just exist, don't they, pallets? You take them for granted, but, you know, somebody makes them and staples them together.
We used to take plastic carrier bags for granted, didn't we? And then
yes, that's true.
Pretty much
yeah.
all stop using them now. I mean, it's just you just get your head around it and move on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're prone to a lot of, you know, abuse on site, aren't they? I mean, you've got, for a start, you're loading them up with, you know, a ton or so of materials, which obviously takes its toll, and you're picking them up with a forklift and carrying them hither and thither. They must be subject to a lot of wear and tear. Do you think that they repair them as well if they see one with a split plank? Oh, well, we'll nail a new one on there. Or do they only use the pristine ones and recycle those?
They do repair them. I mean, obviously, they're not going to, you know, completely put them back together. I'm sure sometimes they're beyond repair. But no, it is a repair service as well. Recover, repair and reuse is the mantra. They say it's
sure.
the shift in mindset from deliver, distribute, discard to recover, repair and reuse. And the statistics are quite staggering. 18 million pallets a year are manufactured for the UK construction industry alone. I mean, God knows
really?
How if you include agriculture and other, you know, manufacturing,
well, yes,
whatever.
Exactly.
Construction
yeah.
alone, 18 million pallets a year. Almost all of them are binned / burnt. 10% of construction waste is made up of pallets, apparently, I'm told.
Yeah.
So it's a massive thing.
It is. And, I mean, the thing is, I'm sure that a lot of, well, in fact, I know that a lot of pallets aren't burnt, because there is an industry which actually depends quite heavily on old pallets, you know, end-of-life pallets, I suppose you would call them, broken ones which can't be reused.
Rabbit hutches.
No, rabbit hutches. But, no, chipboard, particle board.
Oh, of course, yeah.
If I mean, my information might be a little bit out of date because it's a while since I had anything to do with this particular bit of the industry. But certainly a few years ago, 75% of chipboard or particle board is made out of recycled pallets. Nearly all the wood is recycled in a pallet. Very little of it is actually virgin timber. It's easily chipped up, and of course you mix it with resin and you compress it, and then you cover it with melamine, and bingo, you've got a B&Q kitchen. And in fact, you know, it's a huge industry. I just wonder what the board product people think about this. You know, is it going to take a load of pallets out of the market and they're going to have to get waste wood from somewhere else?
Well, you just made me think that what's good for the pallet industry and the planet is bad for chipboard prices. Is the price of chipboard going to go up because they can't source raw materials?
Well, possibly, yeah. I mean, as you say, swings and roundabouts, maybe there are other sources of waste timber, but I imagine that pallets must be a major source. Because, I mean, one of the things that this organisation stresses is the fact that so much material, so much of this timber is used once and then thrown away. And if by thrown away we include recycled into chipboard, well, that's, you know, that's doing some good. And also another thing which I thought about when I saw this story is that, in fact, although this is an excellent idea, it's not entirely original. There is already an organisation which I believe is US owned, but they're active in the UK and in Europe, called CHEP, C-H-E-P, which I don't know if
I've heard of them.
Acronym.
I don't know why. What do they do?
They make blue pallets. And it's a very similar sort of thing. I don't know whether or not the model is exactly the same as this one, but you basically rent the pallet, and I know that the model, you know, the business we're talking about now is like the sort of deposit sort of model. You pay a deposit for it, and I imagine that CHEP's system is more or less the same. But I'm sure a lot of our listeners will have seen these bright blue pallets on site, and if you Google blue pallets, there are several things that crop up saying, don't throw these pallets away, they're not yours. So there is a system already out there to try and reuse and recycle these pallets.
CHEP is not in the UK though, is it? It's just a US thing, is that right?
It's a US owned, but I think they're active in the UK. I haven't checked that, but I mean, certainly we see their pallets over here. Maybe they've come over on ships from the States, but I think they have operations here and in Europe. So, you know, it's a, I'm not denigrating our pallet loop thing. Well, I think the more the merrier. And then in fact, they might operate in a slightly different way, but certainly it's not unprecedented. People already do this. They already sort of recycle and reuse these blue pallets. So in a way it's something that's already happening, but the fact that more people are doing it, it can only be good, in my opinion.
So here's me being quite excited about pallet loop, and you're telling me there's nothing new there, Phil. Move along.
Well, I'm not saying there's nothing new, because I haven't looked into it in sufficient depth. They might be doing it in a completely different way. But all I do know is that the idea of reusing and not necessarily recycling, but certainly reusing pallets isn't new, and CHEP certainly do it. They do it in the States, and I think they do it here as well.
Well, I think we'll see it.
That's killed that conversation.
I think we'll see it gathering momentum either way.
I think we will. Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's a great idea, and I think more, you know, more power to them. I think it's something which should be encouraged.
More pallet to them.
More pallet.
What would you like to talk about next?
An interesting story which you posted just the other day about PFI, which is a phrase really which hasn't passed my lips for a long time. PFI, the Private Finance Initiative. It was the go-to way of procuring expensive public sector infrastructure at one time back in the day. And it's back in the news again. And why is that?
Well,
you know why it is.
I pegged this report, news item I put up this week, only on the back of a guidance document which the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, part of the Treasury, the IPA, has published, mm-hmm. called Preparing for PFI Contract Expiry. It provides guidance for public bodies, local authorities, faced with the ending of PFI contracts in the next few years. Now, the story starts and PFI started, and no one quite really thought about the end of it too much, because it was all 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But the current story began, as I see it, in June 2020, coming up two years ago. The National Audit Office brought out a report called Managing PFI Assets and Services as Contracts End. And they found, quick recap, background, PFI is used for procuring a major piece of infrastructure. One of the first projects on which the whole idea was based was the Dartford Bridge. Trafalgar House paid for, built the bridge, and every time someone drove over that, they gave Trafalgar House a little bit of money back. In the olden days, Trafalgar House would build a bridge, and the government, Department of Transport, would say, thank you very much, there's your 100 million or your billion or whatever the bridge cost. This way, the state gets its bridge for nothing, but only 30 years after it's built, and Trafalgar House gets its money from tolls, and there's a clear revenue stream. It all became more complicated when clever people thought, oh, well, we can build a hospital in the same way. But there's no revenue stream for a hospital. We don't have private health. We've got the NHS. We don't pay for health. It's someone has to pay someone to cook the meals and wash the floors. So Tarmac and Carillion, as they became, or Interserve, as we came to know, would say, well, we'll build your hospital and we'll mop the floors and cook the dinners for 30 years. And you pay us to mop the floors and cook the dinners, and that's how we'll get paid for building the hospital. Upshot is, it was an awfully expensive way for the government to buy things on the tick. It's always more expensive. You can afford to buy something up front, always cheaper. And the chickens came home to roost, bringing the pigs and the goats and the cows and everything else with them. The whole farmyard came home with the chickens to roost. The heyday of the PFI procurement was about 20 to 30 years ago, and those 25, 30-year-old contracts are coming to an end. Over the next 5 years, the National Audit Office report warned, wherever we got 72 PFI contracts representing £3.9 billion worth of assets are coming into public ownership, into public ownership. Over the next 10 years, 200 plus projects representing more than £12 billion are coming back into public ownership. And you might think, well, isn't this good? The state's getting its crown jewels back. Isn't this a good thing? it would be. As long as we know that what we're getting back is what we're thinking we're getting back.
There's a rub.
This is what the National Audit Office was warning two years ago. It was saying that, let's get the quote here, there's a danger that some important infrastructure could return to the public sector in an unsatisfactory condition and services could be disrupted. And there's also this, they politely put it, that the PFI companies, who tend to be owned by institutional investors these days, will seek to skimp on the last few years and hand back to the government things, bits of asset which are in a state of disrepair or falling down, all a bit rubbish. So what the National Audit Office said, Treasury, Infrastructure and Projects Authority, you guys, you need to get a grip. You've got to take the lead here, hold everyone's hand, tell them what to do. Now, the report this week is not the first thing that's come out over the past year or so, I understand, but it's an important piece of work that has come out to tell people this is how you need to prepare. These are the precautions you need to take, that when you're taking this piece of infrastructure, this bit of road, this hospital, these schools, whatever, back into public ownership, this is the work you need to do. And the bottom line, as far as I can see reading this report, is one, get consultants in, contract consultants, get lawyers in, make sure you read tiny small print of the contracts and get your QSs in, get your charter surveyors in to do asset condition surveys of everything. So just bring in consultants left, right and centre, chuck money at them, get them to sort the problems out, because there'll be hidden problems there that the PFI companies will be seeking to hide from you. No, we can't trust them. Get your consultants in. And this is my take on this story. It's a field day for construction consultants, lawyers and surveyors, which I think is quite interesting.
Well, it is. Do you think that the NAO suddenly, National Audit Office, suddenly thought, oh, dear, somebody sort of woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh, this could turn really nasty if all these... it's like, buying a house and moving in expecting to find vacant possession and finding that they've left all their crappy old furniture in the house and you've got to pay to get rid of that. It's you're taking possession of a valuable asset and you've no idea what you're buying. You're buying a pig in a poke. Well, you're not buying it. You're just taking possession of it.
Or they've taken all the light fittings. That's the worst of it. Never happened to me, but I've heard of people coming in and no curtain poles, no light fittings.
No, exactly.
Not even the switches.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's like that one, only on a massive scale.
£12 billion.
Well, yes, yeah. And I suppose it's logical that you would expect that you'd have to do due diligence, but I'm sure that a lot of people probably just focused on the fact that they were going to be taking possession of these assets, and probably the fact that they've been running perfectly adequately for the last 30 years probably reassured them in the belief that perhaps they just have to take, you know, sign on the dotted line and take over the reins. But presumably it's far more complicated than that.
But, well, one in three public authorities, what the National Audit Office found, one in three public authorities managing PFI contracts are expecting to have to use litigation. They're expecting legal disputes,
really?
Over the end of contracts. It's just kind of like, yeah, of course it's going to go to court.
Wow.
On the plus side, well, most don't. Two in three are not expecting it. Two in three are going to be surprised.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. Well, I never.
So it's been a can of worms from the get-go, PFI, and it just continues to be so.
Whose idea was it? I always thought that it was John Major's idea.
No, it sort of came to... It predates that. I mean, it was sort of... It didn't come out of nothing. It came in... Design, build, finance, operate.
Yeah, was the, deep boot.
And then design, build, operate, transfer was another. With these sort of contractual models. And when that was applied to things like... the Channel Tunnel was never quite that, but the Dartford Bridge was.
Yeah.
And I think the... Was the Second Severn Crossing a deboot as well? Toll bridges work perfectly because an asset that wasn't there, people go, why should I have to, you know, pay a toll to go over that bridge? And they go, well, you can either pay a toll or you can go the long way around. We won't build the bridge. What do you want?
Yeah.
You know, it's voluntary.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, this all seems fair enough. But when the principle is extended to things which don't have an obvious revenue stream attached to them, whether it's prisons or IT systems and so on, it all becomes slightly more spurious. And point one, I mean, because it's all to do with risk transfer. The whole benefit, and the initial thing of getting Trafalgar House to build the Dartford Bridge is that they know where the construction risk lies. Let them say how much it's going to cost, and if they build it for less than that, well done them.
They're quits
keep the change. And if they screw up, it's their own bloody fault, and they've got to, you know, they've got to stump up themselves.
Yeah.
And why should the taxpayer have to pay for stupid construction companies? So that's the principle, and that all seemed great because, if you remember back in the day, everything the National Audit Office ever came out with was how appalling the construction industry is at building things. Things were late and things
always over budget and behind schedule. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's passing the risk to the private sector, who, you know, is where it should be, was the idea. But the bottom line is the buy now, pay later principle is an expensive way to pay.
Yes. A lot of people were against it from the start, weren't they? I mean, I know that certainly people on the sort of political left, the Labour Party, well, actually, Labour under Tony Blair probably used it.
They absolutely went gung-ho on it.
That's true, they did.
The hard left were against it because of the implications, particularly in hospitals and so on. It suggested the privatisation of public services.
Yes,
While healthcare was still public, there are a lot of, you know, the laundries, the food, the cleaning and everything. It all went to the private sector, who were perhaps not members of, would it have been NUPE in those days, National Union of, or COSY, or the trades unions of army
sure.
for public
yeah,
sector
Yeah, public
workers.
Sector unions,
They tended to get... their powers eroded by the privatisation of these services. So that was where the political flak was. I don't think the Dartford Bridge, for example, was ever particularly controversial.
No.
So, and I don't think there's even the environment outcry there is today about the Lower Thames crossing. But that's a subject for another day.
Yes, indeed. Right, okay, well, that's a can of worms waiting to be opened, I guess.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Not all of these things are roads and buildings that are these PFI projects. There's some odd ones like, there's a military accommodation estate, and there's a tax office estate, there's IT projects, there's helicopter fleets and various strange things.
Mm.
But there's a lot of work for construction consultants and construction lawyers there.
Yeah. Are we done, Phil?
I think we are. Any other business? Anything else we want to talk about?
No, I can't think of anything else that we need to discuss at the moment.
Oh, People, listeners, we are weekly again.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you to Procore, our sponsor, our awfully nice sponsors, who mean that we are back with you every week. But for this week, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.